Hello, everybody. It's Sam from Financial Samurai. And in this podcast, we're going to talk about when earning $1 million a year isn't enough to retire early. Now, before I begin, I just wanted to give a personal update because I've been tremendously busy. So busy, it just feels like, I don't know, I'm back to banking when I was 22, 23 years old, getting in at 5:30 a.m. until, I don't know, 9 p.m. And the reason why I've been busy is because I was reinvigorated. There's a saying that goes something like this: have kids and the money will come. And I didn't understand that saying at all. But now as a father, I clearly understand that saying, because what happens is once you start seeing your kid develop, you just get so motivated to work harder to ensure that your family does okay, that your family can have the best that you can provide. And so when I've seen my son just develop, you know, through milestones of crawling, walking, talking, and trying these little things here and there, it just, he inspires me so much. And so the past weekend, I basically was working from around 6:30 a.m. until midnight with a couple hour break, obviously, you know, maybe 3 hour break, just food, maybe a nap and so forth. But these were long, long hours because I just looked at him and I said, you know what? I can't waste my time slacking off. I've got to work hard. I've got to be a good father, I've got to spend time with him, and I've got to build the business. So I finally decided to do some outreach by reaching out to larger publications like CNBC and Business Insider to tell the Financial Samurai story. And I spent a long time writing a 2,000-word guest post for CNBC, basically talking about how our family of three don't have normal day jobs so we can be stay-at-home parents and take care of our son, and to talk about the importance of passive income. So I submitted that post on a Monday, and then they edited it, and then they published it on a Tuesday, and then boom, it went crazy around the internet. It was like a top trending story in Apple News, number one trending in CNBC. It was syndicated on Yahoo Finance, and I just got a tremendous amount of coverage and a tremendous amount of traffic, and the revenue came in, and it was just so satisfying to come up with an idea and execute. And seeing the article online really made me feel like a proud father, because it was a picture of myself and my son walking in the park in the middle of the day, and it was just so awesome to see him just on all these different websites, obviously protecting his privacy in the process. Anyway, that's why I haven't been writing any new posts this week. Maybe I haven't been really responsive in the comments, and I'm just starting to do this podcast on a Friday, even after the post was published on a Monday. But better late than never, and so let's get started. The goal of this podcast is to discuss whether making $1 million a year is worth it. Now, only 0.1% of Americans make $1 million a year or more, so you're obviously in rarefied fields, and we learned from a previous podcast that different types of career tracks you can take and entrepreneurial tracks you can take to make $1 million. The best way to make $1 million, if you can get it, is to be a CEO of a public company, because you make the most amount of money and yet you're the least effective person. Think about it. If you leave the company still runs just fine and you get all these stock options and so forth. And the hardest way to make $1 million is through performance, your own performance. For example, being a tennis player, good luck winning that match if you don't play, or being a portfolio manager at a actively run mutual fund or a hedge fund. You've got to either outperform or you're not going to really get paid better than your peers. So this podcast highlights an Asian woman, Rachel Chen, who is a sole income provider, who's a mother of two boys, and she has a husband who's a stay-at-home dad. She's a hedge fund manager at a $1.5 billion hedge fund. She's 45 years old, lives in Brooklyn, New York City, and toiled as a research analyst for 6 years on the sell side before making the leap to the buy side as an analyst at 28. At 37, she was finally promoted to portfolio manager, and most recently, she finally made over $1 million. So her husband, Colin, who is 43, has been a stay-at-home dad since their second son was born in 2011. Colin used to make about $350,000 as a strategy consultant, but got tired of all the travel and decided to give up the grind, especially after Rachel's career started taking off. So Colin has been working on a nonfiction book to keep intellectually stimulated, but it's hard to stay focused with the kids and his wife's robust earnings. So the first thing I want to say is that it has never been more profitable to make $1 million a year. Thanks to tax reform in 2018, not only did the top federal marginal tax rate get cut from 39.6% down to 37%, the income threshold for the top federal marginal tax rate also rose from $418,400 to $500,000 for singles, and from $470,700 to $600,000 for married couples. Also, the marriage penalty tax pretty much got abolished in 2018, because now singles making $300,000 a year can combine their incomes and get taxed the same rate, whereas in the past, it wasn't the case at all. So essentially, if you're going to make $1 million in 2018 or beyond, you're going to save about $15,000 in taxes. It's not huge, but it's better than a poke in the eye, especially if you don't really need it compared to poorer people. But the problem with making a lot of money, as I've said many times before, is that your lifestyle tends to deteriorate due to longer hours at the office, more stress, more responsibility, poorer health, and less family time. I strongly believe your happiness does not increase after $200,000 a year as an individual and $350,000 a year as a family. Trust me, folks, I have observed my happiness at various levels, and it's nice to make more than that, of course, but if it's at the cost of your health and family and friendship and hours and all that stuff, it's really not worth it. And even if you were making it completely passively, it doesn't do anything really except add zeros to your bank account. So if you click over to the post, I put together this really comprehensive chart on their income statement, and it's a really detailed chart that I recommend you guys check out. So on a gross salary of $1 million, they contribute, or she contributes, $18,500 to the 401k and $6,000 to the health savings account. For a salary after 401k and after HSA contribution of $975,500. Now, taxes are a killer. The total combined effective tax rate is 41.5%, and that consists of 37% marginal rate for federal, 31% effective for federal, New York state tax, 6.85% marginal, and then there's the city tax at 3.87%. So, after taxes, they are left with $568,521. So think about that, folks. You started with $1 million, and now you've got 43.2% less than $1 million. A lot is going to taxes, so this is why a lot of high-income earners, W-2 earners, are quite disgruntled when people say, hey, we should raise your taxes even more to pay for things. Paying $407,000 in taxes is a lot, folks. That is basically 8 times the average median household income in the United States just in taxes alone. So if you want to make $1 million, it's best not to earn that money in W-2 wage form. Instead, earn it as a freelancer or as a business owner, because you have a lot more expense shields that can shield your income from taxes. Now, after all the expenses, they are left with about $54,000. Right, so they started with $1 million and they're left with $54,000 in savings or cash flow. So that's 5.4% of gross income or 9.6% of net income. It's not a lot, but if we look at the details, which we'll talk about now, you can understand why so much of the money has gone out the window. So first one, private school tuition, $100,000 a year. Since they're in New York City, they have 2 sons attending the Dalton School. It's a private school from K to 12. Tuition for the 2018-2019 school year is $48,450 a student, folks. That includes books, computer tablets, and lunch. So we're just adding a mere $1,550 a year per child for fundraisers and miscellaneous stuff. And so boom, right there, 2 kids, $50,000 a year, that's $100,000 a year. Now, given mom and dad went to Yale University, they'd like their children to also go to Yale University. They know that Yale and all the prestigious private schools have a legacy system, which frankly I think is kind of weird now in this society today, which basically gives children of alumni a huge leg up in admittance. We're talking about a 3x. So if you have a 10% chance of getting in, you now have a 30% chance of getting in as alumni. So it doesn't matter your racial or economic background, and given most folks who attend these universities are white and are wealthier than average, a lot of people say, the legacy system is also called the Affirmative Action Program for Rich Kids. So think about that, folks. Yes, it's great to have that family, you know, multi-generations going into the university. But if it's at the cost of quality of student because the family has donated a lot more money, that seems kind of off, don't you think? I mean, that seems kind of against the spirit of higher education institutions to provide education for all people and equal opportunity for all people who are deserved. So the Chens, they contribute a maximum gift limit of $60,000 combined to their children's 529 college savings plan, and they're fortunate to have paid off their student loans years ago. So in the post, I've got this great chart that talks about the cost of private school tuition from kindergarten through college, and that total outlay is $835,000. Now, if you just get a risk-free rate of return of 2.85%, that total cost is $1,080,000. And if you just get a 5.4% return, that's about $1.39 million. So frankly, if I was the kid, I'd be like, send me to public school. Hopefully it's a good public school. Cut me a check for $1 million+ when I graduate from college. It'll really help me in my life, mom and dad. But that's just me, especially since everything is free on the internet. But again, that's just me. No qualms. If you're already rich, send them to private school. That's cool. The next big line item is food and entertainment, about $4,600 a month or $50,000 a year. New York City is the best city in America for food and entertainment. I mean, San Francisco does have some amazing food. Maybe it's better than New York City, but if you combine the entertainment aspect as well as the food, I think New York City is number one. So my favorite restaurant, one of my favorites, is Le Bernardin. It'll easily cost about $300 a couple with some wine pairing. So that's $600. And then if you want to hit a show afterwards, you know, hot tickets like Hamilton, I mean, they were trading for, what, $2,000 a ticket. That's crazy. So, you know, the Chens aren't multimillionaires, so they're settling for $250 tickets, right? So that's $500. So in other words, a date night out easily costs $1,000. And so good thing they only go to shows about once a quarter because they're often too busy or too tired to do anything more than have a meal at their favorite local sushi restaurant for maybe $150 to $200 total. Housing is the next big expense, about $10,000 a month or $120,000 a year. So they own a 5-bedroom, 3-bathroom, 2,700 square foot brownstone in Park Slope, Brooklyn. They bought it in 2012. This is basically at the bottom of the market in this recent cycle for $2 million. Now the house is worth $2.8 million or 40% appreciation just 6 years later. So when their first child was born in 2008, they had owned a $1.3 million 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom condo on the Lower East Side that they bought in 2004, and then they quickly realized they needed more space for two kids. So, if you think about the cost, $2.8 million to $3 million, I guess that sounds like a lot, but really it's only 2.8 to 3 times her, Rachel Chen's, gross income. So in fact, that's quite affordable. With a $1.5 million mortgage and a $1 million income, They can make it happen. We're talking about property tax of $18,000 a year, and then maybe $10,000 in maintenance expenses and so forth. So folks, if you want to buy an affordable house, I wouldn't spend more than 3 times your gross income. And you can stretch to 5 times because rates are still quite low, but affording a house comfortably is more like 3 times your gross income or less. The problem is with the state and local tax deduction cap at $10,000, they're going to be losing out on thousands of dollars of tax deductions when they file their 2018 taxes in 2019. And this is going to hit a lot of coastal city property owners. And I don't think they really realize how much of the tax loss they're going to see. And it's going to bum people out after they pay their taxes in April 2019. And I think that's really going to be a catalyst for a slowing housing market. Vehicles and transportation. We're talking almost $3,000 a month. This is clearly an extravagant expense. Colin is a car enthusiast, so he drives a 911 Porsche S, and then Rachel has a Range Rover Velar. And combined, the cost, the lease payments are about $2,250, and then they pay, you know, ride-sharing fees and subway fees on occasion. Again, they live in Brooklyn. It's probably not necessary to have 2 cars, but then they have parking for the 2 cars. And Colin likes to go to his country club to play golf, play some tennis, go for a swim a couple times a week. And then they go for a weekend jaunts with the Velar to the Hamptons, to Connecticut, to Jersey Shore, wherever, right? I mean, it's a perfect family car, and it's not the biggest of the Range Rovers. Next big line item, vacations, $40,000 a year. Now that sounds like a lot. It does, but remember, there are four people, so maybe that's only $10,000 a year per person. The Chens, they take three vacations outside of New York City a year, plus a combined week's worth of local vacation scattered throughout the year. So given Rachel works 65 plus hours a week, vacations are extremely valuable to her so she can recharge and spend quality time with family. The thing is, even when she's on vacation, she's checking in with her analysts and following global stock markets at all hours. This is the problem being a portfolio manager. You're always being affected by something. For example, when the Turkey Stock Exchange imploded by 20% because Trump said he's going to raise tariffs and there's just no confidence in the government because the government doesn't want to raise interest rates, that caused the U.S. markets to collapse, emerging markets to collapse, and affects positions all the time. Being a portfolio manager is tough because it's just always on 24/7 if you want it to happen. And vacations are so important to Rachel because she feels a tremendous amount of guilt being away from her kids for so long. But she also realizes she's in an enviable position to maximize her career earnings while the stock market is still hot, right? She's earning top 0.1% income. And she's a woman, and only, I think, 2% of the sole income provider households are women, so she's a unique person. Eventually, the market will turn, and it'll become much, much harder for her to outperform. So finance is a super, super cyclical industry. So you gotta press when things are good, and then just buckle down when things are bad. So each international trip for a family of four costs roughly $13,500 to $14,000 for the week. And this is not extravagant. The cost is broken down as follows. $4,000 to $6,000 for economy class international flights, right? They like to go to Europe mostly. And then $4,000 to $5,000 for 7 nights at a 5-star hotel or renting a villa. And then $2,000 to $4,000 for food, excursions, and souvenirs. So the remaining $5,000 out of their yearly $40,000 vacation budget is allocated towards being a New York City tourist. Because why not? There's so much to do in New York City. So the next line item is clothes for four, $24,000 a year. What, $24,000 a year? Well, hey, Rachel loves clothes and shoes, and Colin doesn't mind dressing up nicely to match his lovely wife, although he prefers to wear athletic gear all day. So Rachel's a fund manager. She's in a male-dominated industry. It really is a male-dominated industry. So she needs to be taken seriously. She wants to be taken seriously. So she has to dress nicely. She's got her power suits from Gucci and Chanel. They easily cost $2,000 to $4,000 each. And then, you know, you've got to buy shoes, matching shoes, maybe some Jimmy Choo's or Manolo's that cost $1,000 to $1,500. And then you've got to have a power bag, maybe that's $1,000 to $5,000. I don't know, especially if you look at those Hermes Birkin bags. I mean, those are like $8,000. It's like crazy. But the ensemble of clothing that is required to be worn by folks in these high-powered positions costs a lot of money. I mean, why mess around? Image is really important. First impressions are very important, especially your marketing to fundraise for your new fund, for example. People like to see people who are dressed professionally. It gives them confidence that, hey, if I'm going to give you money to manage, you're not going to screw it up. So image is very important. Next line item, charity, $25,000 a year. So that's 2.5% of their gross income, which is pretty consistent with families across America. They feel extremely fortunate to be in their position as second-generation Americans whose parents worked lower-income jobs such as waitering, busing at restaurants to help put them through school. So the Chens feel that it's very important to give back. They're particularly passionate about helping foster kids get through a difficult system in order to be given a fair chance at life. They know their sons are extremely fortunate to attend private school. And deep down, they feel guilty. They feel that it's not fair for their kids to have so much while other kids have so little through no fault of their own. But it's not like they're going to take away opportunities for their sons. They're looking to help other kids try to compete on a more equal platform. And also, they donate to organizations that do research and spread awareness about nystagmus. Nystagmus is a visual condition their youngest son inherited. Nystagmus is a neurological condition that causes involuntary movement in the eyes, which leads to worse than 20/20 visual acuity, even with the use of glasses, contacts, and surgery. Nystagmus can lead to poor depth perception and slower speed of tracking, and it may also be accompanied by other things such as strabismus, which is also called lazy eye when the eyes aren't quite aligned, that require patching or glasses. One thing I want everybody to know is the definition of being legally blind. Being legally blind is having a best corrected visual acuity of 20 over 200. In other words, even with contacts or glasses, the person's visual acuity is no better than 20 over 200. Now, for most people with glasses or contacts, we can correct our vision to 20/20 and sometimes better. Now, with folks with nystagmus, for example, oftentimes their best corrected visual acuity might only be 20/40 to 20/80 or 20/100. So these folks need some accommodations such as larger font size or sitting up next to the classroom and so forth. So I just wanted to throw that information out there so that everybody is more educated and more understanding. There are a lot of conditions people have that are not obvious. And the more we understand, the more we can empathize, and the more we can get along as people. And I'm really happy to spread awareness about nystagmus on behalf of the Chens. So in conclusion, the net worth summary. Rachel has a target of working for 15 more years until her youngest son graduates college. This is a really normal target for most people, really logical. Once both their kids are done with school, this will free up about $200,000 a year in after-tax children-related expenses, which is equivalent to roughly $340,000 in gross income based on their 41% effective total tax rate. So after 15 years, the Chens should be able to accumulate at least another $1.6 million. Now, that doesn't seem that impressive since she makes $1 million gross income a year, but if they consistently reinvest the proceeds at $107,000 a year for 15 years and earn a 6.2% annual growth rate, they'll get to $10 million in net worth. $10 million, pretty good. So that's 10 times their annual gross income, which to me is a little bit light because I think you need to aim for 20 times. But given their kids are going away and all that, they only really need to live off about $500,000 a year in gross income to maintain their pretty extravagant lifestyle, right? It's pretty good. Now, so that would coincide well with 20 times their annual gross income if they get down to $500,000. And if they can find a way to earn 5% on their $10 million, then they can live off $500,000 gross income for the rest of their lives without even touching principal. So that's pretty good. But if I was her, if I was them, I'd really figure out how to optimize those expenses and shoot for $20 million in net worth. Because hey, at the end of the day, you can pass on to your kids about $11 million in net worth per person. So why not? So on paper, everything looks pretty good for the Chens. Yet Rachel tells me she doesn't know if it's worth working 65 hours a week for the next 15 years. Even the finest lobster at Le Bernardin or the most picturesque luxury villa off the Amalfi Coast gets old after a while, folks. It really does. Like year after year, come on, same thing. And they go overseas 3 times a year, right? So Rachel sees a therapist every other week to help her manage the constant pressure she feels to provide for her family. And we talked about this before, being a single income earner is really, really a lot of pressure, especially if the partner doesn't work or have any side hustles. And she has this constant pressure that she needs to outperform the market and outperform her peers. Again, this is a performance-related job. She's only being paid because she is outperforming. The market takes no prisoners, and every month she starts with incredible anxiety because she's only as good as her last month's performance. So this type of pressure has begun to pulverize what little peace and quiet she has left inside. She's also recently begun to develop heart palpitations, which has her worried. I used to have heart palpitations when I was working in finance, and it's kind of like heart arrhythmia. I had an EKG strapped on me for 12 hours once, and of course, it didn't really find anything. But, you know, this stress really does kill. Colin also sees a therapist once a month to help him get through his feelings of unworthiness for being a stay-at-home father and other issues. He's a great dad, but he often feels gutted to have given up his management consulting job for his kids. None of his friends, who all work, understand what he's going through, and he feels isolated and oftentimes depressed. Sometimes he gets jealous of Rachel's success, which leads to bitter fights, right? She, you know, goes to these fancy dinners, gets wined and dined by the sell side. She gets to speak at conferences. I mean, she's a rock star, whereas he's, you know, just the plus one. So what Rachel misses most is spending time with her boys, who are growing up too fast for her liking. Like middle age, where she now has a greater sense of her mortality, she knows that she might only have 5 to 6 to 7 years left to spend time with her sons before they would prefer spending all their free time with their friends. And before she knows it, they'll be off to college, where she might be lucky to see them twice a year. And Rachel also envies Colin's time at home with the kids. Most of her girlfriends are stay-at-home moms who take turns hosting playdates with her kids. When they're in school, they often go to brunch at places like Blue Water Grill in Manhattan with bottomless mimosas over mounds of freshwater oysters while their husbands make the big bucks. And then Colin envies Rachel's freedom and the thrill of working in the real world with power. So as you can see, not all is well in the land of $1 million a year income earning households. It requires a lot of work, a lot of stress, a lot of diligence, and a lot of sacrifice. And further, it doesn't bring any more happiness. So the only way they can live a freer life is to drastically reduce expenses, have Colin go back to work, but I don't know if that's going to be good. It'll be good for him, but that it doesn't solve Rachel's issues of not seeing her kids. Or they're just going to have to change their lifestyle completely by leaving the industry or leaving New York City. At their current $500,000 annual burn rate, Rachel will truly need to work another 15 years to finally experience the joys of financial freedom. And I'm telling you, folks, 15 years more in this industry, cutthroat industry, it's really hard to last. You can have several good years and then several bad years and then you're done. So if I was Rachel, I'd either ask for a 3-month sabbatical or dial back work to 40 hours a week and see if she can still perform, or just say, hey, I don't want to be a portfolio manager anymore. Maybe I'll just be an industry analyst. You know, making $500,000 a year with less stress, fewer work hours, and a lower effective tax rate sounds so much more reasonable. Sure, they have to cut back, but you know what? They'll gain back so much more quality time as a family. So I hope this podcast gives you an idea of what the top 0.1% go through, and hopefully it makes you realize that being in the top 0.1% income earners isn't really that much different from being in the top 50%, for example. Everybody has their own problems. Everybody wants the best for their kids. Everybody struggles with work-life balance. It's all about the same, except that the stress seems much, much higher. So if you feel envious of these high income earners, I wouldn't be envious. They get used to it and they're no more happier than you. The happiest people are the ones who figure out how to spend the most time with their family. It really is the case, and who find friends and who find hobbies and relationships that they can stick with for the long run. Those are the happy people. The unhappy people are the ones who keep on trying to chase prestige and money to no end, because there's always another dollar to make, folks. All right, I'd love to hear from all of you on whether you think earning $1 million a year is worth the stress, and how long would you be willing to work for $1 million a year before you decide to retire early? Thanks so much.